This is Whitley Strieber, and this is a Dreamland video presentation. You have reached the edge of the world. I would like to welcome one of the most special people I know here to Dreamland today. We are in some ways very simpatico, as you will hear. Kathleen McGowan is with us. She was with Philip Coppens for many years. Philip, of course, is the author of The Ancient Alien Question, and we're going to be primarily talking about the whole ancient alien phenomenon today. It's been poo-pooed in the media endlessly, but as it becomes clearer and clearer that somebody is here, it also becomes harder and harder to just blindly accept that they've never been here before. Why would not they have? After all, our entire history is only a wink in the eye of time. Not even that, a twitch. And who knows how often or how extensively we have had contact. We're going into a period of open contact now. Not today, probably not tomorrow, but over the next 100 years or so, it's going to become more common. And I think it probably is something that has happened before. Kathleen McGowan is really an expert on this. She's been on basically on Revelations with William Henry, and subscribers do go back to those Revelations and also go back to the Canopus meditation in the subscriber area, meditation area. The ancient Egyptians thought of Canopus as a stargate, and that's powerful, that meditation. A lot of people believe it's one of the most powerful on this site. So, welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you, Whitley. It's so nice to be with you again.
Yeah, it's nice to be with you again, too. You lost Philip, and I lost Anne.
Yeah.
And so here we are in communication still with both of them.
Absolutely.
Can you begin by telling us a little bit about what your life is now with Philip?
Well, it's funny. I call him my beloved who is beyond. but I also say often that he's in the next room, you know. I think it's been a little over 8 years now since he passed. Going into 9, and you know, it took me a long time to get to a place where I could laugh and smile before I cried. But I'm in that place now, and part of that is this sort of phenomenal relationship that we have developed since he's passed. You know, Philip died very unexpectedly. He got ill very quick. You know, he passed within just a couple of weeks of his diagnosis. So we didn't really have a lot of time to plan. But in the last few days of his life, he said to me, I have to do this. Like, something's been shown to me that I can help more from the other side than I can help from staying here. And I'm going to be there for you. We just have to find a new way to work together. And he meant it. And so a lot of the last years have been about me navigating what that means. And certainly at first it was, you know, I was so grief stricken and in the beginning that it was just absolutely impossible. But, you know, as I started to heal, and then also work with some other people who were very sensitive. And I think that you've had this experience too. When I couldn't hear it, other people could hear it. And what was happening is people were coming to me saying, hey, we're getting messages from Philip. You know, do you want them? And in a lot of cases, they were messages that nobody else could have possibly understood, right?
The same thing precisely happened between me and Anne. That's why we ended up writing a book together after she died.
That's amazing. I can't wait to read that book. What's it called?
The Afterlife Revolution.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that's why she's here and why I wear both rings, because, you know, we're still working together as far as I'm concerned.
That is so beautiful.
I can see you and Philip are too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. He's still my research partner. I'll tell you the thing that he does, and he just did it again this week. I write about this on Facebook all the time. He throws books at me.
And does the same thing precisely.
Really?
Yeah. Research partners, aren't they?
Yes. They're my. He is still my research partner. And it never fails. He'll throw a book out at me and I'll hear a thunk and I'll get up and it will be. And like this week, I was kind of puzzled because I wasn't sure why it was that particular book. But as soon as I opened it and started paging through it, I understood what he was trying to tell me. Right. So it's always something that I really need to know based on whatever I'm working on at that moment.
As Anne left here, a book fell out of our bookcase. And the book was very important because it was open to a page that tells one of the great secrets of the world, which is the reason the universe exists. It was that the universe, the Big Bang occurred, but due to a single primordial quest for knowledge. And when that was lying open there as Annie left, I knew. Now, subsequently, our relationship is different. It's much more synchronistic. She doesn't throw books out, but they do come. And mm-hmm. I really rely on her for research. People ask me my latest book, Jesus, A New Vision. How could you have done all that research? And mostly, you know, when I'm with people who aren't kind of aware of all of this, I say, oh, well, you know, I'm very determined. But the truth is, I don't need to be determined because Anne is a really good researcher.
It's really amazing how similar our stories are.
And, can you believe we're even talking about this? I mean, we're talking about our dead colleagues still working with us and lovers. It's extraordinary. Yeah. I think it's wonderful.
It's wonderful, and I really hope that it gives people. I hope it gives them hope. I think it should. It's certainly been so important in my grief process.
Mine too. Oh my goodness, yes. I don't experience grief, although I will say Anne said one thing when I was in deep grief. Very lovely, and to anyone who is in grief or experiencing grief, she said, don't fear your grief, Whitley. Grief is another form of love. Mm-hmm. And that gave my heart a lot of peace. Okay, now let's go on to this remarkable woman sitting here. And I'm going to tell you a few remarkable things about what make her so remarkable.
Oh, thank you.
She is the author of The Expected One, which we have talked about on, I believe, on this show and certainly on William Henry's Revelations before. She had a vision of Mary Magdalene in Jerusalem, and it completely changed her life. Mary said, "You must help me. You must help me." And she started on what we have described on our website before as one of the great spiritual journeys of modern times. So we're going to talk about ancient aliens pretty extensively today, but I want to start by talking about that journey and its evolution, Kathleen. Where is it now?
Oh my gosh. Well, that happened in 1997, that first sort of experience with Mary Magdalene at that level. You know, it's funny because when I started off on this journey, I started off to write a nonfiction book about women in history who I felt had been maligned and misunderstood. And I didn't have a particular connection to Magdalene per se. I do have a genetic link to that part of France that I ultimately ended up writing about. I had a family link there. But I was never really close to that side of my family, and I wasn't particularly interested in anything that had to do with Christian history, honestly, until I started researching this book. And I started researching women who I felt really had been given a bad rap in history, and I wanted to retell their stories from a new perspective. So initially, I was working with Marie Antoinette and Anne Boleyn, Lucretia Borgia, women like that. And back in about 1993, 94, a friend of mine came to me and said, you know, for this work you're doing, I think you really need to bring in Mary Magdalene. And I said, I don't want to do anything with Christianity. And she said, no, I really think that you need to consider this. And her point was, which was very well taken and true, is that Mary Magdalene actually proved my thesis. So from a purely cerebral point of view, from an academic and research point of view, she proved my thesis because the church had acknowledged that Mary Magdalene had been intentionally misrepresented, right? And that was my thesis from the beginning, that women in history had been misrepresented. And so initially this was very cerebral, very historical. But then once I attached to this idea of Mary Magdalene being sort of the key, I began to study her and then came upon the information about how she had come to France following the crucifixion and essentially founded her own version of Christianity. And that was when I got really pulled into who Magdalene was. And, you know, at that stage, I was Alice. I was on the other side of the mirror. I was down the rabbit hole and I've kind of never come back. And she's really been my muse ever since. She has taken me on this extraordinary journey of understanding. And part of that journey has been about dealing with grief, right? Part of that has been what it's like to take horrific events, challenging events, and transmute them in a way that makes us better people, that makes us better leaders, that makes us better humans. So she got me through my widow's journey, for example. So she's been a very important part of my world and remains so.
Well, she is mine, very much part of mine too, in my new book, A Jesus New Vision, I talk about the Mary Gospel, which I believe is the Mary Magdalene Gospel.
And absolutely.
The remarkable things in it, such as God is not called God in that gospel. God is called the good. And how the whole journey, the whole Jesus Magdalene journey, is about that. It is about finding your place in the good and the good's place in you. So, you know,
yes, my favorite sentence is, and Mary turned their hearts to the good.
Mary turned their hearts to the good. Now, okay. We have the ancient alien question. Let's go on now. Here's the perspective, folks, that I want to bring up here. And that is that there are going to be, over the course of the summer, revelations to the effect that somebody is here. And if you look on Twitter or anywhere, there are people frantically trying to debunk the Tic Tac UFOs and all of the other UFO imagery. There's a move afoot under the surface, I think, to try to claim that some of these are actually Russian devices. And why would they want to do that? Because they want to get funding so that we can try to duplicate them and back engineer them. And second, they don't want to say the truth. And the truth is too huge. And a big part of the truth is this has been going along on a long, long time. It isn't someone from another planet discovering us and landing on the White House lawn and giving the president perhaps a clear cell phone or something. Not at all.
No.
This is about us. And it's a deeper thing than anyone who is in the front lines talking about it now knows. And I suspect also, since I think their ideas reflect the inner hidden state's ideas, it is deeper than the state, the government, has ever realized. Now, let's go back to the beginning. And I want to just preface it a little more. I don't like to talk too much because this is your show, not mine. But there's something I have to mention that has been appeared recently, which is that it's been discovered that wormholes could exist. And not only that, we have the materials necessary to create a wormhole that could conceivably enable the movement of a human body across a very great distance instantaneously. Now, if we are even speculating about that in the sciences, fast forward a million years, and that's going to be more common than a Tesla, for goodness sakes, or a Ford. There could be people who don't just travel the universe, but can step across it in an instant. And I think they may have been here a long time. So, Kathleen, the ancient alien question, can you start with your whole take on it? You have a wonderful preface in here. And if you found finding your common ground with Philip and how you began to get into sync about the whole idea.
Yeah, well, initially, you know, I think the joke has always been that he called me Scully because he was very definitely Mulder. And I was a skeptic. I was not the UFO kind of gal. It was not my field, and I was skeptical about it. I didn't necessarily believe in contact initially so much as I believed in him. And, it was in my time with him and that he really sort of brought me around to a new way of thinking. And, you know, the thing about Philip is he was so passionate about this subject, but he wasn't a proselytizer, right? He was not an evangelist. He was not out to preach any kind of gospel. He just wanted people to think. He wanted people to ask the questions. That's why the book is called The Ancient Alien Question. He was always about, let's just keep asking the questions and see where it takes us. And I think for me, my resistance initially was not that I couldn't imagine that there had been contact. My resistance was that I had this fear that if we acknowledged that there was something greater that was working with us, that maybe it made us lesser as humans. And I was worried about that. And that I wanted humans to have credit for amazing things like the pyramids and Stonehenge and et cetera. And what Philip really made me understand was that both of those things could be true. And that was where the bridge was built for me. It was like, oh, wait a minute. Humans could be incredibly amazing and capable of all these things. And they could also have had contact with other intelligences that were helping them to get to this place. And that was kind of how I made that bridge. And, you know, I just got off a plane. I've only been home for 2 days. I've just spent the last month in Egypt. I've been in Egypt a lot over the last couple of months. And, you know, I find myself in places like the Valley Temple and Abydos, where there are stones that weigh 1,200 tons. And the precision of how these temples is constructed is something that there is no way in the 21st century we can recreate. We don't have any idea how they did it, and we can't do it now. And when I stand in places like that, you have to be able to ask questions. You have to be able to say, how did this happen? Who built this? What created this? Because we don't know. And I think that's beautiful. But I think that we have to really be able to accept the fact that there must be an answer that we have not opened ourselves up to, right?
You'd think so. There must be. Tell us a little bit about, we need to take a break. We're a little late on it. So we're going to take a little break, Free Dreamlanders, and you're going to see some cool commercials that you have probably seen and done nothing about before. But please see them and do something about them today. So we'll be right back. We're talking to Kathleen McGowan. Her website is kathleenmcgowan.com. We're talking about Philip Coppin's book, which she has a new version has been published with a preface by Kathleen. They were very close, the ancient alien question. And just before we left the air, you mentioned that you were recently in Egypt. And of course, this is the middle of COVID. And I'm curious because one of my dreams is to go to Egypt. And I'd love to know what your situation was. Was it difficult? Are you vaccinated, et cetera?
I am vaccinated.
Yeah, so am I.
I was there in January before I was vaccinated, however. And I'll tell you, the Egyptians are managing COVID really, really effectively. And they've done a really good job, actually. And, you know, they were there in January. People were in masks, particularly in the cities, right? You can't enter an archaeological site unless you have a mask. They're quite careful. I will say, you know, places like Cairo it might be a little more prevalent, but where I was, mostly in Middle Egypt and places where it's really sort of deeper in the desert, and there's essentially no sign of COVID in those places. Certainly none that I encountered. But when I went back this time, I was vaccinated, and I'm feeling really optimistic about travel opening up now, and I feel that Egypt is safe in all kinds of ways right now. You know, it's they're so desperate for people to come back. They really want us there. You know, they're so welcoming to us now because they just really want to show us that it's safe and it's beautiful. The Egyptian government is spending huge amounts of money to improve the infrastructure, and they've just built these two gorgeous new museums. And I really want to start encouraging people to consider Egypt for their future. And I'm going to lead a tour there about this time next year, I think next April. Because I really want to start helping people to get there and taking a look at what all the magic that's there for us.
Well, if some of the free Dreamlanders finally actually become subscribers, maybe I'll be able to go with you. It's been my dream a long time, but I have to run this website because it's important, and it's the only one like it in the world. And that comes first for me. And my books stopped selling many years ago in any large numbers because of being marginalized. And anyway, that's neither here nor there. What is here is that I'd like to go on now. And you know where I'd like to go with the book? A book, by the way, folks, is a real, really good read. And the reason is that it takes you so many places. Let's start with the ancient alien puzzle. If you have a copy of it, and do you remember that particular passage, Kathleen, on page 33 of the book?
If you read it to me remind me what it is, I've read it many times.
So. Sure. The UFO phenomenon and the ancient alien question have often been mixed and woven in a rich tapestry. The UFO phenomenon is generally agreed to have begun on June the 24th, 1947, with a sighting by pilot Kenneth Arnold of 9 shiny, mostly disc-like objects flying past Mount Rainier. Only extraterrestrials, it was concluded, had technology that could fly at such incredible speeds, 1,200 miles an hour. Since then, UFO researchers have accumulated evidence, which they see as further confirmation of the extraterrestrial nature of the phenomenon. At the same time, leading UFOologists like Jacques Vallée, especially in Passport to Magonia, and Robert Emenecker in UFOs Past, Present, and Future, have argued that the phenomenon began far earlier than 1947. So that's kind of where I would like to start. If we could go back into the past and talk about what evidence there is, but more importantly, let's try to explore what it did to our civilization so that we can maybe understand, using history, what might be happening to us now, because they're back. quite, they're not here for the first time. They're back.
No. Right. If they were ever gone.
If they were ever gone. Well, they were definitely in the background. In, right. You know, there's a crop formation from the 17th century that was mentioned, known as the mowing devil, which is obviously was a crop circle. And there, as Jacques Vallée points out in Passport to Magonia, there are all kinds of evidence from the past that fits the UFO phenomenon that we're observing today.
You know, Philip's motto was that ancient knowledge will give us a future. Right. And he truly believed that if we did not work to really grasp what the ancients knew and how they knew it, that we would not necessarily have a future. Now, he wasn't a doomsdayer. He was quite the optimist, actually. But he did truly believe that in order for us to really progress and repair some of the things that are wrong in our modern world, we were going to have to really dig into our understanding of what history was really made up of. And if we had the ability to communicate with intelligences that could help us to create these extraordinary structures, then we still have the ability to communicate with these intelligences in a way to repair some of the damage that has been done. And that's the kind of, that's what he was working on, actually, at about the time that he got sick. He was working on a new book about pyramid power, where he really wanted to explore how pyramids around the world had been used as extraordinary energy devices, but also as communication devices. And that one of my favorite chapter in the Ancient Alien Question, and I love the book, and I'm not just promoting it because it's Philip's book. It is a beautiful book that asks so many amazing questions, but also gives so much information. But his chapter on Egypt and on the Great Pyramid in there is really spectacular. And he also talks about the Pyramid of Saqqara, where the pyramid texts are. And he talks about how important that was as a communications portal. And that was instrumental in the work he was doing, and which I am now kind of picking up and doing myself in Egypt, is, you know, what was happening in these pyramids? Were they communication portals? What, you know, what kind of rituals were being used in there, and what kind of information was coming through them? So I guess this is a long way around to say that I think that we are in a place right now as a civilization that we need to figure out some things, because we've got a lot of repair work to do from humanity. And if we have the ability to get some help, then I think we should be getting some help.
Absolutely. You know, the Saqqara pyramid is of enormous importance to me, because the text in it, which I have actually learned hieroglyphics, he says laughingly,
wow,
to translate myself, I think the last text of soul science. It is the first religious text we have. It's the oldest religious text we have. The interior of that pyramid, the Saqqara pyramid, the text is on the walls. The pyramid itself is a book. That is one of the most sophisticated texts in the world. And it's certainly among the very most sophisticated religious texts, and it's the oldest. And that is so remarkable. Tell us, what is this? What, in your opinion, is the general thrust of this effort to reach us? I guess it's an effort to reach us. Because I know from the Jesus book I did that somebody was there who was not like a normal, they were not normal people. The woman who anointed Jesus with nard, the man who provided the upper room, whoever provided the donkey that enabled him to go into Jerusalem, whoever taught him as a child whoever was with him in Egypt, these were not ordinary people, because that man, after his death, turned into a being of light in that tomb. And that is very clear now.
Yeah.
Who were they? And the platform at Baalbek, who built it, and the pyramids themselves, who had the ideas, who created the incredible, subtle, sophisticated written language we call hieroglyphics?
Right.
So the floor is up to you. It's you.
Do I have the answers? I do not have the answers. but I'm deep in the search for them. I will say that. You know, one of the things that I've really been looking at is the connections between these civilizations, the connections between Egypt and early Christianity. Is that's the sort of cornerstone of the work that I'm doing right now, because obviously there are deep connections between those two, you know, extraordinary civilizations and religions. So there is something that connects Egypt and the early Christian movement in many, many ways, right? There's lots of threads for it. And we see that with Nag Hammadi. We see that with, you know, all of this material that has been found written in the Coptic language, that so much of the important wisdom was preserved in Coptic, was preserved by the desert fathers and mothers who were living out safe, where they were safe, right? In the desert in Egypt, where they weren't going to be persecuted. And that's why, you know, these very, very important texts, whether it was the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, which was found at the end of the 19th century in Egypt, or the Nag Hammadi texts, you know, that's why they're all coming out of Egypt, because there was a movement happening there to preserve and protect this material. I believe that the Egyptians were communicating with whatever we want to call those intelligences, whether, you know, the gods are in fact, you know, higher dimensional beings of some sort. And I'm kind of open to everything and attached to nothing, honestly, when it comes to this. I try to stay in that sort of position of I know nothing. I just am asking the questions. And that's how Philip was. Like, I don't want to say I think it's this or I know it's this. I don't. I just want to say I continue to look and here are my observations. And my observations are that the Egyptians were clearly having extraordinary conversations with other beings who were not here. And that the result of that has been some of the most exceptional architectural, sociological, and communication events in all of human history. And I think it's time to look at all of it again. You know, I'm studying the connections right now between the big temples. And for me, the center of the universe is the temple at Abydos. So it's the connection to Abydos, the connection to the big valley temple where the Sphinx is, and Saqqara. I think those three places, hold such an important, they hold so much important information about human history, going also including, and I'm sure this is a place that is meaningful for you, given the work you've done in Saqqara, the Serapeum in Saqqara. The Serapeum with its enormous, enormous vaults that weigh hundreds and hundreds of tons. You know, what was happening in there? What was being stored in there? What were they protecting? There was, you know, there's just so many exceptional mysteries that we dig into. I guess my question for all of us is, will we ever know, and does it matter how it was done? As much as does it matter what we can do now? And I think those two things go together. I'm just still in a space of trying to figure out how to put it all together.
We need a new kind of empowerment in order to survive. The technological empowerments and scientific empowerments that we have achieved are fine. They're not enough. They will not help this. They will not enable us to survive. They'll help, certainly.
Right.
But we need an asymmetric skill of some kind. And I think that when we look at these constructions all over the world, at the pyramids, at Sacsayhuaman, at Nan Madol, that weird thing in the Carolinas, those artificial islands that are made of basalt, big, huge basalt logs, we need to understand much more about why they were made, what they did or can do, and what the techniques are involved, because they are not normal construction right. techniques. Something else was done. And speaking of something else, Free Dreamlanders, I know you're as entranced by Kathleen's discussion as I am, but be even more entranced. Let us work a little commercial magic on you, and please do. They're probably going to suggest you buy the Jesus book in this one and do it. It's a wonderful book. There's never anything written like it. And if you like Ann Streber and her delivery of herself, it's all through the book. You won't read it. It's not there, but you guys know enough to know how I did all that research. We'll be right back. We're talking to Kathleen McGowan. Her website, kathleenmcgowan.com. Her own journey, the book, The Expected One, is powerful. It is a very, very useful book. And I want to kind of circle back now to your journey, Kathleen, because I feel like it's a very important journey. And tell us where you are with it now. How are you engaged at the present time?
Well, I have a book coming out later this year called The Magdalene Way. And it is, it's kind of a hybrid. It's a little bit of history of her life in France and my journey collecting the evidence and the information on her life in France, which has now been going on for, 27 years, I think.
Yeah.
Almost 30 years that I've been sort of on this Magdalene path. And it's also, it's lessons, from her life. It's lessons that I learned following her path through history. And, so it's part history. It's part inspirational. It's part journey. It's really the story of how, I have followed her and it's very specifically focused on what happens to her following the crucifixion. There's so much material, including my own books, about Magdalene as partner, Magdalene with Jesus, Magdalene during the period of Jesus, and her work with him while he was on earth. But what happens following the crucifixion, once Magdalene is on her own, in the physical world, because she's never on her own spiritually, she becomes such a fascinating character. And we're not talking about that enough. And that's for me, the 21st century Magdalene is so relevant because she is about surviving and thriving, right? And she is also about taking her spiritual understanding to the next level. And this idea that Magdalene was not just Jesus's partner and companion, but essentially his successor, and then took these teachings and then even enhanced them further once she arrives in France, once she gets there. This is a woman who almost single-handedly converts the nation of France, almost by herself, starting with converting the king and queen of Provence. So the amount of determination, perseverance, faith that she would have had to possess in order to accomplish this after having endured the unbelievable trauma of dealing with what happened in the Holy Land and everything that happened with the crucifixion, etc. She's just such an icon for me of what the divine feminine is about. And it's funny because there's so much information in French that has not been translated. And that's been a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last 20 years is getting into the deep, deep, deep into the French sources that write about what her life was like when she was there, what she accomplished, what she did. You know, there's lots of artwork and of her preaching. You know, this is a thing that we don't think of. We think of Magdalene in this old fashioned way where you see her penitent and weeping and her hair growing around her body. And all of that has absolutely nothing to do with Mary Magdalene. It's actually not her story. That's somebody else's story. Magdalene's story is a powerful, powerful story about survival and thriving, but also about teaching. If you look at what's happening in the Renaissance art, you start seeing a difference. All of a sudden, it's portraits of Mary Magdalene reading, you know, and you start seeing this educated woman. You start seeing the queens and the noble women of Europe painting themselves as Mary Magdalene. And that's because, A, they believe that they were descendants of hers, but also they were spiritually descendants of hers. They were spiritually powerful women. So a lot of my work now in this new book that I have coming out later in the year, The Magdalene Way, and if people want to know about it, they can just go, if they go onto my website, KathleenMcGowan.com, they can just sign up for the release details and it'll be in there. It's going to have information about Magdalene in France that has never been released before. In addition to, you know, talking about these sort of extraordinary things that she did to create a version of Christianity that was entirely opposite of the version of Christianity that was evolving in Rome. You know, so we always say it's Roma versus Amor. It was, you know, the cycle of what happened in Rome, which was, you know, all about economics and power and this very hierarchical, patriarchal situation versus Magdalene, who comes to, you know, this western, southwestern part of Europe and finds refuge in places where there were goddess communities. Every place where there is a Magdalene, a major Magdalene center or church that goes back to antiquity was originally a goddess shrine of some sort, usually to Minerva or Athena or Diana, and even Isis. There were some Isis temples as well. So we see that, you know, Magdalene came, brought this way of love, brought this incredible understanding of divine union, right? Not having anyone between you and this experience of gnosis, of understanding. This is all about you and the good and you and God. She brought this, came and found support in these goddess communities, and then really was able to thrive and create this completely different version of Christianity, which, you know, sadly was condemned by the church and was almost entirely wiped out. But gosh, if that version had thrived as opposed to the version that was really all about control and power, I think we would be looking at a very different history of the Western world.
Very, very different. It would be a different Western world entirely, because, you know, the most basic difference is this: the pursuit of the good begins in your own heart, and following after a distant God begins in your mind. That's the difference. And we lost that. Yeah. But it's what's so fascinating to me is the pursuit of the good is not passive. Otherwise, the Shroud of Turin wouldn't exist.
Agree.
It is a very powerful, active force. And we don't engage with it anymore. And she did, and he did. They were married, surely. I mean, they must have been man and wife.
Of course they were.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely.
They were. And that's why the church, in its effort to turn him into a distant figure, called her a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And made those up those stories about her. But they wanted to distance Jesus from us. And the Romans, Constantine, made him into a god. Right. So that he would not be human, and that we would have to worship him through the institution of church and state that existed then, rather than engage with him in our own heart and in our own way. But of course, he gave us communion, which is a totally is the most common man, common woman sacrament ever created. The other sacraments in those days were extremely elaborate sacrificial rituals that most poor people couldn't do. But Jesus's sacramental ritual was all you needed was a crust of bread and two people and you were in business.
That's right. Okay.
Now, someone has been here a long time trying to do something with us, Kathleen. I mean, Ezekiel's wheel wasn't a fantasy. The reason I say that with such conviction is that how could a man who knew nothing whatsoever about travel, heavier than air travel, have made up anything like that, or rocketry either for that matter? You can't make things up that you have literally never conceived. So there we are.
Well, and I also want to go back to the Shroud of Turin, which you mentioned, because I think the Shroud of Turin is arguably the most important relic that we have in the world.
Absolutely.
I've spent a lot of time on the Shroud. I think you have too.
Yes.
And Philip and I were deeply involved with the Shroud, and I've been to see it many times, and I've gone to view all of the collaborating shrouds, the Shroud in Oviedo and the Shroud of Manapello. But the Shroud of Turin is so important. And sadly, you know, like so many other things in this field of trying to look at the world in an open way and invite in all of this information, you know, we're so bombarded by critics and we're so bombarded by false information. So when I say this, when I talk about the Shroud of Turin to the average person, they're like, oh, well, they proved that was a forgery. And it's like, no, yeah, they did not. You know, none, that is not true. It is not correct. It is not accurate. The Shroud of Turin remains the one of the most, if not the most important relics, items that we have of the power of consciousness, right?
Yes.
It's the power of consciousness. It created that imprint on that fabric, an imprint that has not been able to be copied or repeated or, you know, understood in any possible way. And so I always go back to the Shroud and say that power of consciousness is what that's our holy grail, right? This is what we're supposed to understand. Whoever is trying to communicate with us is trying to show us the power of our own consciousness. And we just keep civilization, you know, since the age of reason on down has put so many blocks between us and this understanding of consciousness. And I think that's a power thing, right? If we understood how truly powerful we can be, what we can truly create with consciousness, then we would not be able to be controlled, right? And I think that's a big piece of it. And I don't want to get into the idea. I don't want to get into all the conspiracy stuff about who's trying to control us and all of that. I want to stay focused on what our power is, right? And why it's time for us to really reclaim this and really understand the power of what consciousness is. And I think that's what Magdalene was teaching. I think that's what Jesus was teaching. I think that's what you're finding in the early Gnostic Gospels. And I think that is what was eradicated by Constantine and all of these other councils when they pared everything down to a very simple set of documents that they could control.
Well, you know, I'm going to send you a copy of my book, Jesus, A New Vision. You'll enjoy it, and you'll also enjoy Anne's excellent research.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah. She would have loved to be in on this show, and she is in on it in some way, I'm sure.
She's here.
Yeah, probably Philip is too, and laughing their heads off, no doubt. But now, let's talk a little bit about there are a lot of ancient aliens theories that are very negative, that, you know, that the archons were enslaved us and the strange fixation on, and I think it's a strange fixation that they created a race of slaves to mine gold and all of that. And I'm not seeing that exactly. I think our world would be very different if that had actually happened.
But, I am not a supporter of that theory in any way, and either was Philip. And Philip was really determined to stay in a place of positivity, not in a naive way, but in a place of saying he just never bought the idea that we were a slave race. I don't buy that idea. I think it's a really unfortunate way to look at the world. It doesn't really leave us a lot of opportunity if we look at it that way. Right. So it
almost, if we were a slave race, we clearly got out of the paddock somehow or another,
I would think. I think the story enslaves us, doesn't it? Like if we accept that story, then we've already enslaved our consciousness by saying we're trapped. And that's just not a place that I can ever go to. And Philip was very much the same. I mean, he really wanted to stay focused on, let's look at the positive side of what contact is, which is not to say that he didn't investigate abductions and that he wasn't interested in people's stories. It's just that he really wanted to focus on this idea of connecting intelligences and raising consciousness. You know, that was really his focus. And mine as well. So, I'd much rather stay in that place of, we have been able to create extraordinary things as humanity, over the course of our time on this planet. And clearly we didn't do this alone. The last thing that Philip and I were working on, when he got sick, our sort of last big adventure together was in Bosnia, where we were working with Dr. Sam Osmanagic on the Bosnian pyramids. The Bosnian pyramids open up an entirely new chapter of what all of this can mean, because in terms of their age and their size, they're extraordinary, and essentially they're impossible, right? And yet there they are. So
why are they impossible?
Because of their size, it's just the carbon dating on the organic material goes back 26,000 years, in some cases 30,000. The Pyramid of the Sun is larger than the Great Pyramid. I mean, the mass of this discovery, which still a lot of people are very skeptical about. And
why aren't you? What about the pyramids makes you feel that they're constructions?
First of all, I've spent a lot of time in them, and I've spent a lot of time in Bosnia, and I would definitely invite people who are interested in this subject but skeptical to go and spend some time there. Now, Philip was the first international journalist to write about the Bosnian pyramids back in 2005, immediately after Sam announced the discovery. And as a result, he became very close to the ongoing work and archaeology that's happening there. And he was deeply involved in it for the next 7 years prior to his death. And so as a result, I was privy to a lot of the academic information that came through. It's 130 different academic institutions have now been involved in doing all kinds of studies on Bosnia. And it's really exceptional, but people are afraid of it. You know, people are, including the Egyptians, are really, really afraid of the Bosnian discovery, because if it's real, and I believe with all my heart that it is, I mean, it is clearly man-made when you are there, and these miles and miles of tunnels, labyrinthine tunnels that run underneath them. It's such an exquisite and extraordinary place. And the energy there is unlike anything I've ever experienced anywhere in the world. But the sheer size and accomplishment of an age of what this pyramid structure could mean to human history is really, really scary to historians. And as a result, the skeptics have really made it hard for Sam to get his information out there. But I really encourage people, you know, don't stop Wikipedia. Wikipedia is not going to give you, you know, the in-depth information that you need. You need to really, you know, go onto YouTube, find videos by Dr. Sam Osmanagic, start doing your own investigation into this material.
Can you just hold a moment and spell his name for us?
Sure. Osmanagic is Osmanagic. And if you just put in Dr. Sam or Dr. Samir, Samir, Bosnian pyramids in a Google search, they're going to come up.
So it's Dr. Sam, Bosnian pyramids, folks, in Google, and you'll get there.
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
Because he's got a lot of really, really great videos out there where he lays out the evidence, and it's not only valuable, it's necessary. If you care about the subject matter, you have to care about what's happening in Bosnia, because it really opens everything up to a whole new level in terms of what we're capable of.
Okay, we have reached just about the end of the first hour, Free Dreamlanders, and you're going to go bye-bye now. The subscribers are going to go deeper into this, and this is a time when if you don't go deeper, you're not there at all. And this huge website, Unknown Country, is a gigantic treasure trove of information that is not like what you're going to get in the conventional media. Information like this, like what Kathleen just told you, that can change your whole idea of who you are and transform you into something bigger. We are told endlessly by the world around us, you're little, you're unimportant, and you're nothing. And has a response to that, which is, each of us is all we have. And that makes you very important to somebody. You know who? You. So get with it. Get on the site. You're hungry for this, so you wouldn't be listening to this. Go to Unknown Country and get going and dig into this. There's so much rich Kathleen McGowan material on there and Philip Coppens material, just to name a couple. You can get so deeply. You can find out her journey toward the Magdalene in a perfectly glorious interview she did with William Henry. So there's so much there. Okay, now, subscribers, we're going to go deeper into some of the actual artifactual evidence of what was there and try to take a look at the why. What is the meaning of this long contact that we have had with beings from some other level or reality or even planet? And why is it changing again now? Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest has been Kathleen McGowan. We are talking about the ancient alien question. She has got a new book coming out I'm terribly excited about. You can get started with Kathleen by getting The Expected One. You can link to both books through unknowncountry.com. And don't forget to subscribe to this YouTube channel. So the channel does not get monetized by YouTube for reasons that have to do with YouTube. But I'd like more people listening here. I think it's important. So thank you very much for being with us, folks. Okay, Kathleen, we shall go a little deeper now. Can you discuss with me some of the artifacts that are out there? Things like the Baghdad Battery and that thing that was discovered in the metal in Russia, the Vasha River discovery. Do you know those?
Yeah, that's a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but I will say that the thing that really, really got me in terms of evidence was not something that I saw so much as something that I heard about. And you know, one of the things that Philip was really, really immersed in was information about Roswell. And when it was about, oh, I think it was 2010, 2011, he started working on a documentary about Roswell. And he started working with Jesse Marcel III. So Jesse Marcel is the grandson of the Jesse Marcel, who was essentially the first responder at Roswell. And when he started working on that documentary with Jesse, you know, I knew what most people know about Roswell, right? But he really started to pull me into this deeper, and I got really intrigued by it. So I went with him on the film shoot to go interview the Marcels, and those days working with Jesse Marcel and his family and hearing about what his grandfather actually had found at the crash site and the stories that his grandfather had told him about the artifacts that he had once held, including these extraordinary medals. And these medals had these glyphs on them, which were actually quite similar to hieroglyphs. That was, you know, that was the moment for me, those days when I got to hear that and see the drawings that Jesse had done about the material that had belonged to his grandfather, which has disappeared, of course. But that, you know, the information that he had from his dad and his father had also seen it. You know, this material and the information about how, you know, there was material that was found that looked like aluminum foil, but it was entirely indestructible, right? It couldn't be cut. It couldn't be burned. And how, you know, Marcel and other people that were working with him, you know, they had pieces of it and they tried all these different ways to basically blow it up and destroy it. And it was 100% indestructible. So the fact that, you know, this information was out there and then it was all shut down, that for me was, that was a critical point for me. I believe these people. And when you listen to it from the point of view of a family who has lived with this for three generations and how it has impacted them, and also how it has impacted them because they had to maintain the secrecy of it, right? Whether it was from fear or from non-disclosure agreements, that type of thing. The human story of what happened with the Marcels, knowing this, having touched it, and then having to shut it all down, really was, for me, it's one of the great stories of the 20th century. I ended up co-producing the documentary, which was called Alien Crash at Roswell. It's still, you know, available out there to be seen on demand. But it's worth it because listening to Jesse and seeing Jesse's detailed sketches of what this material looked like. And I keep going back to the fact that the writing on it was kind of a combination of like a runic writing and a hieroglyph. And it's absolutely fascinating. And I know that there is more of this stuff out there. But that, for me, the material that was found at Roswell was really just compelling.
Well, you know, it's so peculiar that you would even bring up Roswell, because I'm sure you can't know that Roswell was in my family. One of my uncles was one of the first officers to deal with the debris when it was brought to Wright Field. And General Arthur Exon, who eventually headed the project examining the materials, was a close family friend, and also the biological material. And so, you know, in the military, everybody who gets tangled up in this knows that the visitors get interested in people who are interested in them.
Right.
I'm going to have a young man on the show quite soon who was a radar operator on one of the ships in the Nimitz event. And he talked to some of the pilots who had seen the things or photographed them, videoed them, and he became interested in this. And the visitors became interested in him, real interested. The fascinating thing, though, in his story is the way it relates back to myth and to the ancient gods. And so I want to segue here a little bit into an area that I think you're probably quite familiar with, which is the connection between what we think of now as mythological beings and the possibility that they aren't simply imaginary or imaginal, but reflect relationship with real entities of some kind.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's funny, you know, because I'm very much in an Egypt frame of mind right now. But, you know, in Egypt, the gods were called netters, right? They weren't called gods. They were called netters, which were forces of nature, essentially.
Yes. You know? So important to understand that, folks.
Yeah, it is so important. It is. And aspects of consciousness is really what they are. You know, I think one of the things that's really evolving out of Egyptology now is this understanding that Egypt was not really, we think of it as polytheistic, right? That they had all of these gods, but it really was more that there was a understanding that consciousness had all of these levels, and each one of these netters or forces of nature governed a certain aspect of consciousness, right? This is why I keep going back to the Temple of Abydos and why I believe that Abydos is the most important of the Egyptian temples and one of the most important religious sites in the world. Because if you go into Abydos, there are different chapels to different netters, and each one of those chapels represents a different aspect of consciousness. There was something happening here at Abydos that was very, very much about understanding consciousness, and that's one of the things that I've been studying. So you go into the chapel of Horus, and then you follow that with going into the chapel of Isis, and then you go into the chapel of Osiris, and then you go into the chapel of Amun, and then you go into the chapel of Rahirakti, and each one of those takes you into a different exploration of consciousness. So I truly believe that this is one of the things that we've lost, with this version of monotheism that has become so prevalent over the last 2,000 years.
Yes.
You know, we have lost all of these nuances. And that's one of the things that, I'm so passionate about bringing back, you know, this understanding that there's so much more to consciousness than that. And that's what I believe is happening with the gods. But I also want to say that I do believe that the Egyptians were interacting with these beings. I'm not saying that these beings didn't exist. I do believe that there were interactions with beings, and still are. There are still people in Egypt who are doing this work, and they're extraordinary people, and it's still happening. And I think it's important. And I go back to what Philip said, that ancient knowledge is going to give us a future, and we need to get back to this understanding of what the Egyptians were doing, because they understood things that we have forgotten. And I think the other question that I have, Whitley, that I think that is really one of the things that drives me is, where did we lose it? Where did we drop out of this? Where did we forget? How did we go from being a civilization that could make these contacts and understood consciousness and forces of nature and was able to contact and interact with higher intelligence and higher beings? How did we go from being able to do all that and create these incredible structures to not knowing any of it? How did that happen?
Boy, isn't that a fabulous question, Kathleen. And I can answer it in 2 minutes, but not these 2 minutes. I have no idea how to answer it yet, but I have a feeling there's a very simple and straightforward answer there somewhere. What is happening now is that we are realizing, some of us, and this is a big reason that you're on the show, because you're more than realize this, you are enacting it, that consciousness has a role to play in the physical world. The bridge to that knowledge is the Shroud of Turin. The body in the shroud was transformed into neutrons, and it emerged out of the shroud as a form of light. That is a reality that the cloth left us the knowledge of. It wasn't that he was something other than human. It was that he was very human that this happened. Now, we are going into a period on planet Earth of great change. It is going to be accompanied by social upheaval of all different kinds. It is going to result in a great decline in the human population, and maybe the whole population is going to decline. What can we do? And the answer comes in engaging consciousness as a real power in the world. And what do you do that through? You do that through addressing the good and becoming part of the good. What you said about the netters is so, so important. Because when I was talking earlier about soul science is study of the netters, not as gods outside of us, but as conditions and powers within us. Absolutely. And they're very consistent, the netters, by the way. If you study, you know, someone ought to write a book about the netters and all of the netters and what each one of them means in the context of the human mind and body.
It needs to be done.
Yep. What do you think of the Osirian? I've always been very moved by it because I got somewhere, and it could have been from the visitors. I'm never sure where some of this stuff comes from, that it was a place of baptism and that people were introduced to the earth through its waters, and the place that they were bathed in the waters of the earth is the Osirian. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, yeah. You know, it's most of the temples, actually all of them that I can think of right now, of the big temples in Egypt, all had water components, certainly. And a lot of that was about you know, vibration. Right. And the water flowed underneath the temples. The Osirian was essentially, there was essentially an island in the middle of that temple. Right. I keep going back to Abydos as the center of the world. I know I keep saying that, but the Osirian is for me like this mystery that is just in my heart. I got to spend some really good time in Abydos over these last few weeks. And of course, this is where the flower of life is as well, right? Right. The what are potentially the oldest known versions of this flower of life symbol are on the walls of the Osirian. We have a construction of the Osirian that we can't understand. I do believe that the Osirian is far, far more ancient than we currently believe it to be. I think the Osirian is one of the oldest structures on the planet. I think it's been there for a very, very, very long time. You know, people in Abydos will tell you flat out that Abydos is a stargate, that that's just what Abydos is, and that the Osirian was originally a place of massive contact between us and other intelligences. But here's the thing. It's the Osirian, right? It's dedicated to Osiris. And Osiris is resurrection, right?
Right. So it's the Jesus. He's the Jesus of Egypt.
Absolutely. So we come back to this idea of what is resurrection and what the Gnostics were saying to us, what we see in the Gospel of Philip, is this idea that we need to resurrect while in this body, right? Resurrect while in this body is what they say over and over in different versions in the Gnostic teachings.
And the kingdom of heaven is within you.
It's within you, right? It's all
but if you're
about
always worrying about getting a new TV and money and and whether or not somebody's going to go to your school and shoot all your children and are the nitinol or people drinking blood behind the scenes and all that stuff, you're not on the path. Mm-mm. You're not on the path of the good. Not at all. What is the path?
Because the path of the good is this realization that being here is the gift. It's not about an afterlife that we need to be good and we need to earn certain points so that we can go on to this afterlife and then win some kind of a prize. It's about understanding that we are here right now in this body. We are conscious and we need to resurrect while in this body. We need to remember who we are. And if you look at the Osiris mysteries need to be retold for the 21st century. And this is something that I am working on because it's so important. Because the Osiris mysteries and the Jesus mysteries, all the resurrection mysteries are critical. And another reason they're critical is because they all involve the power of the divine feminine. Because in each case, there is a woman or women involved with the idea of resurrection. Osiris cannot be resurrected without Isis and Nephthys, right? Jesus is not resurrected without Magdalene and the myrrh-bearing women. You know, all of these things have to come together. And the whole story of Osiris being chopped into 14 pieces and having his wife have to remember him, go out and seek out his pieces and put him back together and resurrect him. I mean, this is the story of the last thousands of years, right? This is the wounded masculine being repaired by the divine feminine. This is about healing. This is about healing our consciousness and bringing us back together, resurrecting while in this body, becoming Osiris, becoming Isis, becoming Jesus, becoming Magdalene, becoming a divine being in a human body, because that's who we all are. That's our legacy. And that's what consciousness is about. And I believe that the Osirian is one of the oldest, if not the oldest temple in the world to remind us of that.
Well, I was helped by my wife. I heard her tell me to ask you about the Osirian.
Thanks, Anne.
Yeah, that was very useful.
Thanks, Isis.
This is the way reality works, folks. She really is here. She really is participating, and she really is good at it. And 100%. So is Kathleen. And so they're actually, I'm the go between, but Anne's doing the interviewing and Kathleen is doing the answering. I wasn't going to say it, but it's true.
I think Anne and I need to write a book together.
You probably could. I mean, she's darn good at communicating with me. She probably would be willing to get involved with you too. And there's a certain sign that Anne gives, which is, if she's there and starting to engage with you, you will start to see white moths in unusual situations. Like, for example, last week, I was with some friends in Texas for the first time in over a year, and they were close friends of mine. One of them, the man is our family friendship goes back, we think, six generations. So we're real close. And yeah, real close. And when Ann first met him, he said to me, "Whit, don't let this one go." And Ann always said that once she heard that she'd gotten his imprimatur, she knew she was in like Flynn, that she would soon be married. So anyway, when I was there, the surveillance cameras are always on in this apartment in the futile hope of catching something cool like a gray walking across the room, which I never have managed. But and that's not true of the white moth. When I was there, the white moth would show up every few hours. And what it does is just flies across the screen and then disappears into the air. And for those of you who are watching on video, I'll show you one of the white moth incidents. But those of you who are listening, these are very common, these incidents. They happen all the time. And so if you see a white moth in an unusual situation, it means that Anne is there and you can start to engage with her.
Oh, that's amazing. I will be on the lookout for that. And Philip comes to me as a blue dragonfly. So
white moths and blue dragonflies get along. I want to eat each other or something.
It's not, I think that they'd be friendly. Yeah, the blue dragonflies show up in the strangest places for me, but yeah, that's how he shows himself as well. So I just think that we're both really, really blessed to,
you know, this is the first time that I have ever interviewed somebody who's working with their departed partner in the same way I am. I think this is a fantastic interview. I'm really just delighted.
Oh, me too. And I do hope, I hope that people, you know, are really getting something from it in terms of this realization that, you know, love conquers death. Death isn't the end. It's just, you know, when Philip was dying, he's, you know, I asked him if he was scared and he said, no, I'm Egyptian. I'm an Egyptian hermeticist. He says, this is just the next journey for me. He's like, you know, you need to, there's nothing to be afraid of here. This is just about learning, you know, to communicate in different ways and on different levels. And that's what he said. He said, you know, we're moving. It was 2012, you know, it was December 21st, 2012 when all this happened. And, you know, it was really the beginning of the shift. And he said, the shift is happening. And he said, a lot of people over the next 10 years are going to move on to the other side. Because they need to be there because they can help us better from there than they can from here. And he said it was going to be, you know, it's going to be our lesson to learn how to work with that. And
right. And with them. And yeah, and the same thing happened with Anne. She was not scared. In fact, she said to me, Whitley, it's your job to make sure I am as conscious as possible, as long as possible. Mm-hmm. Because I want this to be a conscious death. She wasn't afraid in any way. Not at all. Not at all. And then after she died, all of the signs that are known as the signs of the rainbow body in Tibetan Buddhism appeared. And it was really something. I realized, boy, I was married to an incredible being. What a woman. What an extraordinary being. And you were too.
Absolutely.
These are people who have found the power of the good, because it's not just, you know, we distance the whole methodology of praying for help to someone outside of us distances us from the real energy, which Jesus told us where it was. The kingdom of heaven is within you. Oh. And it's practically heresy to say that, because there's a lot of people running these churches. They need money. And the kingdom of heaven's not within you, because I can't charge you for that. Heaven's right in here in this church, and you better come in here and put some money in the plate. Come on, we can do better, folks.
We must do better.
Yeah. Kathleen, tell us a little bit more about the Magdalene book you're writing.
Because we're just the book that's coming out this year, it's currently slated for July 22nd, but because I just came back from Egypt and I might add a few things to it, we might move the release date out to about November. But sometime later this year, The Magdalene Way will be released. And it's partly my journey with researching her and material in France over the many, many years that I've been doing this, in terms of in terms of how she was also regarded in France, why there was such a powerful devotion to her throughout French history, and how French queens always had a Magdalene chapel. And there is a time, throughout France in the Middle Ages, where there was always a chapel dedicated to Mary Magdalene within a day's ride from any town in France. You know, her power as the sort of original queen of France, which is how she's often referred to, is so, so strong. And it's just, it's something that we, outside of France, people don't understand. They don't understand her power and why she was so powerful, right? And so I write a lot about this, about how she in so many ways represents the essence of what is the divine feminine, right? And so the Magdalene Way is about what does that mean? So it's about what qualities do we, how does Magdalene become our role model for the 21st century? What qualities does she have that make her the ultimate role model 2000 years later? She's more relevant today than she ever has been, right? And we see, you know, we see what's happening around the last couple of years in terms of movements like Me Too and Time's Up, where women are coming forward and saying, you know, it's not okay to be treated this way anymore. And Magdalene was such an emblem of that, right? She was the emblem of this woman who was called all of these things, that had nothing to do with who she really was. So, you know, she represents the truth, right? You know, the truth is the realm of women in a lot of ways, because, you know, women historically were not invested in power and economics in a way that they had to twist the truth, which is what happens through most of history, right? History is written by the winners. But in a world where women are the historians and women are the spiritual custodians, we have a different version of truth, and truth is about community and love and the good and how we live in a more harmonious world. And so I really want to bring forth this Magdalene, into the 21st century, who represented all of those things in such a powerful way. The Queen Mother of France, Louise of Savoy, had dedicated much of her life to understanding the teachings of Mary Magdalene. And she had a little book put together called The Life of Magdalene, which goes through what the queens and the noblewomen revered about Magdalene. And the number one element that they refer to over and over again is perseverance. Perseverance. That Magdalene's power was in her perseverance, because you can have all of these other things. You can have devotion to the good. You can have faith. You can have compassion. You can be charitable. But if you don't have perseverance to keep going when times are hard or when times require leadership, then you can't make the difference. Magdalene was an activist, and it is time for activist spirituality. It's time for perseverance. It's time for us to persevere, to be turning toward the good and help other people to get there. So that's what my new book is about, The Magdalene Way.
The Magdalene Way, the Kathleen McGowan Way, the journey of Kathleen and Philip together, our journey back into the past to understand who we really are and to regain the powers that have been stolen from us. This is what this show has been about. Cherish it. There's not going to be a lot like this anywhere else in the world. Thank you so much for being subscribers to Unknown Country and Dreamland. And Kathleen, thank you so much for being with us. KathleenMcGowan.com is where you get started with Kathleen. And of course, you can get her books and Philip's books through Unknown Country.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer,